This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Eliza Griswold, has been writing about the collision of Christianity and Islam over religion, worldviews, land, food, oil, and water. The area she's reported on is the 10th parallel, the line of latitude 700 miles north of the equator. She's reported from the 10th parallel in Nigeria, Sudan, Somalia, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines, visiting places where wars in the name of religion have been fought from village to village and street corner to street corner. Her new book is called The 10th Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. Griswold grew up in a rectory in the 1970s and 80s. Her father, Frank Griswold, was the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church in America in 2003 when Gene Robinson became the first openly gay person ordained as a bishop in the church, creating an international split in the larger Anglican Church. Eliza Griswold, welcome to Fresh Air. You began your investigation of this faith-based fault line in December 2003, when you traveled with Franklin Graham, son of the famous evangelist Billy Graham, who's now very famous himself. Well, where did you travel with him to, and why did you want to go with him?
We went to the northern capital of Sudan, which is Khartoum, and we went to meet with a man who Franklin considers the devil, Hassan Omar al-Bashir, the president of Sudan. And we met with him. This was the first time Franklin had met with Bashir. And he wanted to do a couple of things, one of which was to convince Bashir to allow him, to allow Graham, to reach out to Muslims who lived in Khartoum and in the north.
But Christian proselytizing to Muslims is banned there. It's illegal.
That's exactly right. Northern Sudan, like many of the countries along the 10th parallel, is what's considered a closed country, which means that it's either the letter of the law says it's illegal to proselytize there, or culturally it's simply not allowed. And so Graham was asking Bashir for the right to preach to Muslims there.
And did President Bashir give him that right?
Indeed not. What President Bashir did was try to convince Graham to convert to Islam. And the two men engaged in this faith-based one-upsmanship, where each tried to convert the other to his respective faith. And what happened then was that Franklin remembered that in his pocket he had a W-2004 re-election pin for the re-election of George W. Bush. So he reached into his pocket and he handed it to Bashir. And he said, "Mr. President, you'll be speaking to my president later on today, and I think you should tell him you're his first voter here in the Sudan."
Why did he say that?
In one way, to read what that situation really meant was For Graham was definitely showing Bashir that he had the ear of the administration, that here's where faith and foreign policy were really intermingled, because Graham was not an emissary of the U.S. government in any way. Yet the pin, which he'd taken from the desk of Karl Rove's secretary, indicated that he had access to the uppermost echelons of power. And by the way, Bashir only met with Graham because he was afraid that his country would become the next country after Iraq and Afghanistan to face U.S. invasion.
So was Franklin Graham President George W. Bush's personal minister?
He was. That's a term. You know, he was his personal pastor. And there, when I was with Franklin Graham in his office in Boone, North Carolina, there was a picture of him praying with George W. Bush and Laura Bush holding their hands on the wall, hanging on the wall.
I guess, you know, I'm wondering, when Franklin Graham, who was perceived in the United States by a lot of people as very extreme, when he goes to a place like Sudan, establishes hospitals there, meets with the president, is he seen as representative of what Americans believe?
Very, very much so. And that is one of the more dangerous realities of how conservative evangelicals abroad can shape the perception of the West. Especially, this is especially sensitive in the Muslim world. And this is not new. You know, I mean, this really goes back to post-World War II and the foundation of the Muslim Brotherhood, which largely came out of trying to be a Muslim YMCA, because the only Westerners Muslims saw at that time were Christian evangelicals coming to spread their faith. So this kind of defensive posturing of Islam, Islam is under threat by the West. Unfortunately, a handful of evangelicals can misrepresent what the West is about and make Muslims feel very much under threat.
One of the things you write about in your book is the 1040 window. I want you to describe what that is.
The 1040 window is really a mission strategy that dates back to the end of the 20th century, which comes out of the thinking of a man named Louis Bush. And this is one of the curious—
No relation to the President Bushes.
None at all. It's one of the curious confluences of technology and belief. What Louis Bush did, he used to work at Arthur Andersen Consulting. And what he did was set on a map using satellite technology where the world's poorest people and the fewest numbers of believers, that means of born-again Christians, actually lived. And what he found when he plotted this point is that these numbers coincided with what he termed the 1040 window. He came to that title with his wife's help. The 1040 window lies north of the 10th parallel and south of the 40th. And the 40th is Greece and sort of southern Europe, right? So within this red rectangle, if you look at a map, you're looking at a long square. On his map, this is red. This is the majority of the world's Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, and the majority of the population lives on less than $500 a year. So it's this nexus between the world's poor and the world's what he would call the world spiritually poor. And it's where he and many others believe Christians should focus the efforts of their evangelism.
And how is that playing out today?
That is a good question. You know, I myself have spent time in many of those countries and in Iraq with missionaries who work what some people would call creative access, and this is northern Sudan as well, which means going into a country under other guises, right? As either maybe you're running a clinic, maybe you're running a fabric store, maybe you're teaching English. And what I have found overwhelmingly, I mean, at first I thought, well, maybe I will write about what these people are doing, you know, what it means to go into a country that is against the law, the letter of the law, to go preach there. What I found time and time again is that no matter what the people's beliefs were, what the practical reality of their work was, is they were doing all kinds of NGO work, whether it was teaching English, giving people jobs, teaching people computer skills, things that no matter what their aim might be, the actual result in the moment was pretty benevolent. And that's a long answer to say that what's going on within that window is really unclear. And most times I've seen mission working, it's been to the good.
Let's talk about your trip to Nigeria, where you investigated the collision between Christianity and Islam. Let's talk first about a church you visited that's part of a network of churches that dates back to a missionary named Carl Wilhelm Kuhn, a German missionary who was important in Nigeria in spreading Christianity. Would you describe the network of churches that she helped create?
He created a network. It's really tens of thousands of churches in Nigeria. He came with the idea of expressly stopping Islam's spread in Africa. And his idea was to build a string of thousands of churches like military forts, that's his language, across the 10th parallel, across where he saw the Islamic world end and the world's pagans. At that time, that was the common usage, or, you know, those who follow traditional religions, began. He wanted to make this bulwark in order to stop Islam from, again, his language, winning Africa. And today, the churches he built, these frontline churches, because he himself walked from Nigeria to Sudan, almost died, almost drowned along the way, these churches do serve, in their understanding, as the bulwark against Islam's spread in Africa.
And why is it so important to him and the people in his churches to stop the spread of Islam in Africa?
Well, you know, that the question of Islam as the enemy of Christianity didn't begin with our contemporary times, our contemporary evangelical sort of firebrands talking. It's a much older confrontation. It's a much older contest that really dates back to the late 19th century. And Qom was not alone in this position that, you know, Islam was basically it was the Industrial Revolution, roads, telegraphs, the forces that spread the West and Christianity could equally be used to spread Islam. And it was convenient thinking because it sort of whipped up fervor around the spread of a rival faith. But it was also very much the fear at the time that if the Christian West didn't take over these blank spaces on the map, then the Islamic world would.
So you visited one of these churches in the Qom network of churches in a town called Yelwa. Just tell us a little bit about Yelwa and the specific church.
Yelwa has been the site of some of the bloodiest massacres between both Christians and Muslims of the past decade. In fact, some of the bloodiest happened around September 1st, 2001. And because of the timing with 9/11, what would probably have been picked up by the foreign press just got lost. Thousands killed eventually. Again, with the trouble with numbers, it's hard to know. In one case, Christians surrounding the town, encircling the town. These are all reprisal attacks. So they begin in, you know, one begins the other counterattacks. Christians surrounding the town and killing every Muslim they found within the town. On another attack, the church that you mentioned, this church, which is in Yelwa, was also surrounded, and Muslims surrounded the church and massacred everybody coming outside after morning devotions. So the history of bloodshed here is very, very deep, very, very painful. And both sides have mass graves very close to places of worship that are hard to believe when you see the numbers. You know, 100 men in this hole, 200 children in this hole. It's painful and it's visceral and it's a daily reality. So, you know, here, one of the things that I really learned in the course of this book was that we need people's understanding of religious conflict as visceral and daily is very, very real. And that certainly is one thing that I took away from Yelwa, where, you know, more than coincidentally, Yelwa is largely peaceful now. And the reason is because fighting has cost each side so much, so many cows, so many children, so much land use, that neither side fights anymore because they see it in their interest to be peaceful now.
Now, I know you talked to people who were nearly victims and witnessed massacres. Did you talk to anybody involved with massacres who justified their actions?
Yes. The first person who – many is the answer. I talk to many. The first person who comes to mind is a man named Farhin Ibn Ahmad in Indonesia who had gone to training camps in Afghanistan and come back. He's Indonesian. He had come back, and when Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's one of the architects of 9/11, had come to the Indonesian capital of Jakarta, Farhin had been his emissary, had taken him around. So this guy has some pretty strong ties within the militant world. When it comes to Indonesia, he had led a massacre on the island of Sulawesi, where Christians and Muslims had been fighting, among other things, over a local election. And their real grudge against each other was the cacao boom, money coming from the spiking prices of chocolate around the world. Anyway, so Farhin had led a group of Muslims down a hill to attack a town, and he had wiped out a Christian village. And I went back to that village with him to see what was going on. And that was a pretty illuminating experience.
What did you see?
Well, for one thing, one of the ways in which the village was now Muslim, because the Christians didn't want to live in around Muslims anymore. They had moved up to the top of this mountainside to a nearby town called Tintena. So all the Christians lived on the mountain. All the Muslims lived along the coast. So people were rebuilding this village when we went back. And, you know, Farhin had been tortured quite badly in the course of his interrogation. So that's what he said, and that's what some of the Indonesian security people I talked to said as well. So he'd had a lot of electric shock. He said his mind was like a broken computer. He kind of came and went. So not everything he said was totally clear. But sitting with him, we were sitting in a Land Rover. He was slumped down in the back of the car, and he just kept saying, you know, the Christians wanted to kill the Muslims. They wanted us out of here. This is divine holy war. As if all he could do, he couldn't face what he'd done. And all he could do was kind of rely on these scraps of broken ideology, which is really all he had left.
So we've been talking about your trip with Franklin Graham to Sudan, where he met with the president of Sudan, President Bashir, with the goal of getting permission to convert Muslims to Christianity. And that kind of proselytizing is against the law in Sudan. He didn't get the permission. But the things that you were talking about, I think the conflicts between Christians and Muslims lead us to what's going on in the United States right now, which is the controversy surrounding the proposed Islamic community center a few blocks away from Ground Zero in Manhattan. And I'm wondering how your studies, your investigation of the collisions between Christians and Muslims in the 10th parallel helps you understand what's going on now, if it helps you understand what's going on now surrounding that proposed Islamic community center.
Sure. I mean, what I see in this is the beyond the demonization of the other is a fight really inside of, let's say, the West, but we could say the Christian West or the Judeo-Christian West, between what people's rights are. And the principal takeaway for me from this experience along the 10th parallel was that the real conflicts shaping the future of the world's religions are not between the religions, they're inside of the religions. And so that means the fight over who gets to speak for God, whether that's a liberal or a conservative, whether that's, you know, Franklin Graham or Obama, both of whom are Christians, consider themselves to be, follow Jesus Christ. Those are the real flashpoints. Those are what we need to watch.
So you see it as an internal dispute in the United States between whether it's liberals or people on the right who speak for the faith, who speak for Christianity?
I do. I mean, this whole thing came up, you know, largely overlooked until it became politically expedient to do so, you know, by a blogger to say, oh, now we're going to oppose this. At first, even, you know, Fox News didn't oppose the idea of the Islamic Center. So Everyone has weighed in on their position, not so much about the Islamic Center, but about where they see Islam in American society. And that really reflects that that really is a political issue that one could substitute in homosexuality, gay marriage. There are lots of other issues that would push the same buttons.
Eliza Griswold, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Eliza Griswold is the author of the new book, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jeff Charlotte, recently traveled to Uganda to meet David Bahati, the member of parliament who introduced the draconian anti-homosexuality bill. Bahati is a leader of the Ugandan parliament's branch of the Fellowship, which is connected to the secretive American evangelical group, the Fellowship, that is also known as the Family. Charlotte is the author of the bestseller, The Family, about this fundamentalist group and the influential senators and congressmen affiliated with it. Charlotte's follow-up book, C Street, will be published in September. He went to Uganda at the invitation of David Bahati. Charlotte's article, Straight Man's Burden, The American Roots of Uganda's Anti-Gay Persecutions, is published in the September issue of Harper's. Charlotte is a contributing editor of the magazine. He's also an assistant professor of English at Dartmouth College. Jeff Charlotte, welcome back to Fresh Air. Before we talk about your trip to Uganda, just give us a little refresher course on the anti-homosexual bill and where it stands now.
Well, the anti-homosexuality bill was it was introduced in 2009. It's a bill that essentially seeks to eradicate homosexuality from Uganda and become a model for the rest of Africa. Homosexuality is already illegal, but it would make the penalties much stiffer, including death penalty for what's described in the bill as serial offender. And that can be someone who has gay sex more than once. It also has aggravated homosexuality. If you're HIV positive and you have sex even with another consenting adult and you're aware of things, death penalty. If you have sex with someone who's disabled, again, consenting adults doesn't matter, death penalty. There's also a life sentence for one-time act. There's a seven-year sentence for the promotion of homosexuality and a three-year sentence for failure to report a known homosexual, whether it's a relative or anything like that. And you have 24 hours to do that.
What's the present status of the bill?
Well, the bill was introduced in 2009. It had overwhelming popular support in Uganda. I mean, you could hardly imagine a sort of more popular initiative at that moment. It just sort of seized this kind of this frenzy. And then there was a lot of international pressure against it. And you had Sweden threatening to cut off foreign aid. You had Germany saying, we'll give you a lot of more money if you don't pass it. And it's sort of now gone into this kind of holding pattern. The dictator, a guy named Museveni, had a sort of presidential commission say, look, we can achieve all these ends with current laws. Didn't advise against it, just said we can do it in a different way. And it's now awaiting a second reading in the parliament. And essentially what it is right now is sort of a tiger on the leash. It's something that the dictator can, if he feels he's threatened and he needs to rally public support and distract them, he can get this thing passed in probably about 4 weeks. So it remains incredibly dangerous.
But there have been reports that President Museveni said he would sign this bill only if the death penalty was removed from it.
Yeah, I think that's actually a real possibility that the death penalty will be removed from it. Unfortunately, we have this situation right now where there's especially some of the American groups that have sort of been involved with and supporting it. They're going to declare that a human rights victory, a law that provides a life in prison for homosexuality, long prison terms for even this conversation we're having right now. They're going to call that a human rights victory. The death penalty might be stripped out. I spoke to the author of the bill, and he said, you know, this is democracy. Step by step, we'll get there. He's very confident that, that one day democracy will lead to killing.
You keep referring to Museveni as a dictator. Is he commonly regarded as a dictator?
It's a little bit debated, but he's been in power for, since 1986, 24 years. He changed the constitution to keep being reelected. If he doesn't like you, you get killed. You get thrown in prison. It's a much more softer dictatorship. But yeah, he's pretty commonly referred to as a dictator. I mean, you know, this is not like Gaddafi, this sort of crazed kind of thing. But yeah, he's a dictator. He's been there forever, and no one expects him. There's an election next year, which is what a lot of this has to do with. And he's not likely to give up power. He surrounded himself with a sort of Republican Guard style. Separate military led by his son. He's a dictator.
Jeff, you've been reporting on this Ugandan anti-homosexual bill from the United States, but recently you actually went to Uganda. What did you hope to learn there?
Well, I went really to meet with David Bahati, the author of the bill. Because I'd been reporting on it, we ended up speaking. He invited me to Uganda. He said, look, if you come here, you'll see yourself what's really going on. For instance, you'll see that homosexuals from Europe and America are luring our children into homosexuality by distributing cell phones and iPods and things like this. That no Ugandan on his or her own would ever become gay, but they're sort of bribed into it. And he says, and I can explain to you what I really want to do. Because I've been reporting on it, and here was really the author of this potentially genocidal bill saying, come on over and I'll tell you what it's all about. I thought I had to take him up on that invitation.
How did he know your work?
Fresh air, actually. Because we had spoken about this before, a report on that interview was on the front page, I believe, of a major Ugandan newspaper, it sort of amped things up a little bit. But David Bahati knew my work partly because I had been writing about this organization called the Family or the Fellowship, and he's one of the leaders of the group's presence in Uganda, which is one of their strongest countries in Africa, and a place where they've invested millions of dollars in leadership development. And David Bahati has been over to the United States to study the sort of the Christian leadership principles of the Family, or the principles of Jesus, as they call them. And here I was reporting about this organization, he was upset because he had come into sort of a schism with the group. When the bill became publicized, the American Family, which organizes something called the annual National Prayer Breakfast, the president always speaks there, really tried to distance themselves from Bahati, and at first said that he wasn't invited. And Bahati was very emphatic. He said, no, I'm invited. In fact, I was there in 2007. I was there in 2009. I helped organize the Uganda National Prayer Breakfast in Uganda, to which American politicians come. And I think he saw me as a journalist who could tell his story in a little bit. He wanted it known that he did have these connections, that he wasn't some kind of rube out there, backbencher, that he was a guy who had international connections and had done this bill. He believed, and I should emphasize that, he believed in concert with the goals of his American allies.
So when you met with David Bahati, the member of parliament who introduced the anti-homosexuality bill in Uganda, what were his explanations about why homosexuality is such a threat, so dangerous, as to warrant the death penalty?
Well, this is fascinating, and I think this is where we really need clarification, because homosexuality doesn't really mean the same thing in Uganda as it does here. They don't see homosexuality as something native to Uganda. They see it as something imposed from the West. It becomes a symbol for Western interference, for neocolonialism.
So they see homosexuality as an expression of neocolonialism, something that came from the West?
Yeah, exactly. They see. And this is again. Bahati, for instance, is obsessed with the Netherlands, and he said the Netherlands is funneling homosexuality into Uganda. And he says, of course, Americans are doing the same. And what this actually is really kind of in response to is sort of deeply ironic. You go back to the early part of the decade when the Bush administration created this massive fund for fighting AIDS around the world, PEPFAR. And a lot of PEPFAR money went to Uganda, which actually ended up developing for a while a very successful anti-AIDS program. And the AIDS worker said, okay, we need to talk to the homosexual community. And there was Ugandan government officials say, oh, no problem, we don't have one. And of course, you know, these international health workers said, no, we really need to talk to these people. And these bridges got built. And I spoke to a homosexual activist, gay activist in Uganda, who said, you know, that was really the sort of this political moment for us. And that seeing that, you know, we could be recognized by the international community, we had human rights, that this was a part of it, we could organize. And so both some of the gay activists and some of the anti-gay crusaders point to that moment in the early part of the decade as one of the real catalysts for this battle.
Now, David Bahati, the member of parliament who introduced the anti-gay bill in Uganda, also has religious reasons for opposing homosexuality. Didn't he tell you that it was demonic, a modern form of witchcraft?
Yeah. Everything he does is for religious reasons. He was raised a kind of sort of nominal Anglican, had a born-again experience, came to the United States to study at something called the Leadership Institute in Arlington, which is a conservative group, and got involved with the Family Research Council. He was very impressed by their work. And then got involved with the family, and that was his real connection. And what he explained to me, he says, look, homosexuality in itself is very bad. He sees it as terrible. But he says, ultimately, and this is something he felt that he learned from the Americans, he says, ultimately, it's a symbol for the wrong kind of government. A government that allows homosexuality is a government led by people. In other words, we pass laws and we say homosexuality is legal. He says, we need to have God-led government. And the United States may have strayed too far away from that, but Uganda, that's still possible. So eradicating homosexuality from Uganda is just really part of this larger vision for what both he and his American allies would call a God-led government, although they might differ on what that would look like.
So one of the reasons why you went to Uganda was to try to understand what, if any, influence conservative Christians in the U.S. had on the writing of the anti-homosexual bill in Uganda. Specifically, you wanted to know if members of the conservative Christian group, the Family, had influence. So what did Bahati tell you about input from the U.S.?
Well, on the one hand, Bahati says, no, there's no input from the United States. This is entirely Ugandan effort. And on the other hand, he says, we did it through our fellowship group, our family group in Parliament. And I said, oh, so there's a connection between this American-supported group and the bill. And he says, I don't know what you mean about connection. There's no connection. The bill is the fellowship. This is what we do. So I discovered, you know, thinking that there was sort of a more distant chain of relationship, that there was actually this very direct relationship, even though a lot of the Americans strongly opposed the bill. This wasn't what they had in mind. And they are emphatic, and I think they're right. They say, look, you know, we haven't killed any gay people in Uganda. This wasn't what we had in mind. You know, we didn't pull the trigger. And that's true. They didn't pull the trigger, but there's a sense in which they built the gun, which was this institutional idea of government being decided by small groups of elites, leaders like Bahati, getting together and trying to conform government to their understanding of biblical law, and that this was what was to be done, and that this was what their American benefactors wanted them to do, because you had people like Senator Jim Inhofe, former Attorney General John Ashcroft, Rick Warren, all visiting Bahati's fellowship group in Parliament and all talking about what a God-led government would look like.
So you actually, at David Bahati's invitation, went to his home, had a meal with him and his family. What was it like to be at his home? He knows how much you oppose the anti-homosexuality bill that he introduced in Uganda. He knows that you, more than anyone else, has been writing about it and investigating it. So what was it like to be at his home?
It was very frightening. You know, the first time I met him, we met in a very, very upscale hotel. And to give you a sense of the wealth of this place, you know, we spent, I think, about $100 on lunch in a country where that could take you months and months. You could live on that practically. And we would meet again and again in this hotel. And soon he was saying, I want to talk to you more. And every time I spoke to someone who he thought was giving away what he called unnecessary truths. He would call me up and request a meeting. And finally, on Saturday night of my visit there, he says, we're meeting in the hotel. He says, you know, you have to come to my home tomorrow. And I was a little nervous about that. And I said, in fact, I'm leaving on Monday. He says, perfect. I'm just in time. So with a Ugandan journalist who sort of helped me get around, we went out to his house, which is way high up in the hills outside Uganda. And this journalist who had said, look, you know, the worst that ever happens to you here is if you're a journalist, you get thrown in prison for a day or two. It's not that big a deal. He says this he was a little worried about. But we went, and here's this beautiful home. You could see Lake Victoria. There was a rainbow over Lake Victoria. There's little kids. His two little boys are playing in the yard, and it's a compound. There's barbed wire all around it. There's a guardhouse. There's big steel doors. But once you're in this sort of David Bahati's peaceable kingdom. And he was incredibly gracious and shared this lunch and just sort of calmly spoke more bluntly than he had before about what he wanted to do. And what he wanted to do was kill every last gay person. And this came up because he said, well, the death penalty may come out of it, but, you know, democracy will bring it back. We'll do this. And I challenged him, and I said, David, by your standards, this bill isn't biblical because you believe that the Bible calls for killing gay people. And he said this many times. And
this
said,
is a Leviticus.
Leviticus. He cites Leviticus. And he kind of miscites Leviticus as saying that it calls for the execution of all gay people. And he sighs and he says, and I said, well, so, but your bill doesn't go that far. And he sighs and he says, it's not a perfect world, but this is what democracy is. So we go step by step. And it was a very chilling moment because we're sitting there with this man who is talking about his plans for genocide and has demonstrated over the period of my relationship with him that he's not some backbencher. That this is a real rising star in the movement. And that was something I hadn't understood before I went to Uganda, that this was a guy with real potential and real sway and increasingly a following in Uganda.
Just to clarify, he doesn't really have plans for genocide. He doesn't have plans to execute all gays. In his heart of hearts, he might feel that homosexuality is worthy of death, but he's not proposing that. He's not planning on proposing that. He's not preparing for genocide.
When you speak to his allies, they're pretty clear that this is a project to eradicate homosexuality from Uganda, and they hope it will become a model for all of Africa. They're not saying this is like a reform. They say, we can do this. We are at the crux. And they have these, you know, while I was there, an American pastor, Lou Engel, leads a big Christian right group called The Call, came there and said, this is ground zero of the great war with homosexuality. And so they're fired up by this rhetoric and they think they can do it. But you're right. The real threat is of genocide. And when I spoke to Ugandans, they were aware of this too. The real threat of genocide is not so much killing all the gay people in Uganda because their homophobia is so deep that in a lot of ways they can't see homosexuality. So I would travel around sometimes in these circles with gay activists and we'd speak to anti-gay crusaders who are very certain that they could spot a gay person anywhere. Well, they miss the guy standing right in front of them, this activist I was with. But the real danger of genocide is Uganda is a very sort of loosely knit together country of a lot of different ethnic groups. It's right next door to Rwanda, which, of course, did experience genocide. Uganda has experienced terrible killing, first under Idi Amin, and then the war that brought the current dictator to power killed hundreds of thousands. It's always sort of simmering just on the edge of ethnic conflict. In 2009, there was a huge riot and four radio stations were taken off the air for incitement to genocide. The real danger is if one ethnic group or another, for political purposes, gets charged with being overly accommodating to homosexuality or too connected to the West. And the horrible irony is what's holding that at bay is the dictator who is holding this country together. And if for one reason or another he leaves, and you did face a prospect of civil war, I think there would be the real temptation to demagogues like David Bahati, other politicians who are his allies, to use that rhetoric to pursue political gain that could lead to massive killing.
After David Bahati invited you to his home, served you a meal with his family, he also told you that if you returned to Uganda, he'd have you arrested for promoting homosexuality. Did he mean that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Here's this. I almost hesitate to say this. I rather liked David Bahati. Not to say that his heart is good or anything like that. Bahati is a funny guy. He laughs a lot. It's kind of a giggle that sometimes is sort of terrifying, but nonetheless, you're engaged in this conversation. And I found myself having this much more straightforward conversation with him than I do with many of the American Christian conservatives who have been sort of in the orbit of this issue. He said, yeah, of course I'll have you arrested. You know, he sort of made that clear to the Ugandan journalist I was with, too. And at the same time, he was saying, I'd like to come to the United States. Can you help me organize a lecture tour? So it was a little bit we're in this moment of civility, and everything was very, very civil. And you know, I think that's the horrifying thing when you encounter people like this whose hatred is so deep. And I think a lot of times people have a misconception of what that's going to look like. When someone like Bahati comes out, they think he's going to have horns, horns and a tail, and he's going to be this devil. He's going to look like what Bahati thinks gay people look like. And instead, along comes this very polished man who's studying the United States. He's studying Wales. His education was partly paid for by this Norwegian foundation. He's this very sophisticated, thoughtful guy. You can be almost lulled into forgetting the just enormous fury that's within him and that's driving him, and that he has been able to, unfortunately, convey to a lot of the Ugandan public.
Do you think that the anti-gay bill in Uganda is being watched by other African countries?
Oh, yeah. The anti-gay bill in Uganda is definitely being watched by other African countries. There's about seven nations in the world that have death penalty for homosexuality. Most of them are in Africa. It's very rarely enforced. And now here is this country that has long been held up by the West as a beacon of democracy, pursuing the most aggressive version of this. David Bahati says he's been invited by members of the Zambian government to come and give a presentation on this. They've had copies of the bill requested by different governments. We've seen a real uptick in the political uses of homophobia. And I do emphasize that the political uses of homophobia, we don't want to make that mistake of saying Africans are somehow more hateful than anybody else. It's a political moment right now where a lot of governments in Africa are seeing that they can deflect the public from the really serious issues that they face by drumming up this sort of fear of an alien contagion that builds on this traditional taboo.
So a committee that was formed by President Museveni recommended that this bill be withdrawn by Parliament, but they don't have the power to insist on that. So do you think this bill is eventually going to be passed in its current form or in another form?
The only thing holding it back right now is Museveni, who is afraid of losing support from Western donors. If there was a vote on it tomorrow, it would pass almost unanimously. To vote against it would be political suicide in Uganda. But that said, Museveni is holding it back. He's trying to kind of play both sides. On the one hand, says we've got to go slow on this. Maybe this isn't the right way. And then he'll go and give a public talk about the gay menace. His wife, who is also very powerful, the First Lady, has also talked about sort of purging Uganda. So right now, they're really holding it very much in a holding pattern. It's a threat. It's a politically useful weapon. You know, it's as if they're walking around with a bomb with a very long fuse, but the fuse has been lit. Whether or not this bill passes or its pieces of it are worked into other elements of Ugandan law, that's yet to be seen. The witch hunt is on. But there is some hope because, frankly, the sort of international outcry did have an effect, not only in scaring Museveni, but in waking up a lot of Ugandan Christians, and I should say devout Pentecostal and evangelical Ugandan Christians, who at least turned against the death penalty because of this, and also building support for Ugandan gay activists who suddenly have a visibility, and you know, gay groups all over the world want to say, look, you are on the firing line there. How can we help? So it's not a done deal. The violence has already started, and it will probably get worse. It could get much worse, but there is some hope.
Jeff Charlotte, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jeff Charlotte's article, Straight Man's Burden, is published in the September edition of Harper's. You'll find a link to an excerpt of the article on our website, freshair.npr.org. Charlotte is the author of the bestseller, The Family. His follow-up book, C Street, will be published in September. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.